Hello, everybody. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today, we have the demise of the Beetle, the VW Beetle, that is, the iconic automobile. An ad in 1965 asked, "Will we ever kill the bug?" And it answered itself. It said, "Never." A bit premature. This zesty bit of copy from a legendary ad campaign helped make the Beetle the most popular foreign car in the U.S., transforming the vehicle into a countercultural icon. And yet, on September 13th this year, faced with stalling sales, Volkswagen announced that it will halt production on the Beetle next July. The Beetle was born at the behest of Adolf Hitler, who wanted a practical vehicle for the German middle class. Although associations between the car and Nazism were slow to dissipate after the war, it eventually became an international success and, perhaps ironically, a symbol of a peace-loving era. The Bug's popularity declined after its cheerfully anti-materialistic mid-1960s heyday, but its nostalgic appeal endured. When VW introduced the new Beetle in 1998, it was snapped up by baby boomers and Gen Xers alike. Now, with electric cars gaining ground and self-driving vehicles on the horizon, the Beetle may in its death once again became a symbol of something bigger than one little car. This time, the end of a century-long era of transportation. And that is the first of two items from Time magazine on October the 1st this fall. The next one is The Problem with Storm Categories. North Carolina residents might be excused for breathing a premature sigh of relief when Hurricane Florence, once a Category 4 storm, was downgraded to Category 1 before making landfall. But those numbers don't tell the whole story, and what they leave out can have life and death consequences. Florence is an excellent example of a storm that is a lower category, lower than it was, and yet is still extremely dangerous. Florence especially highlighted one key shortfall of the system known as the Saffir-Simpson Hurricane Wind Scale. While it measures a hurricane's wind speed, it doesn't take into account the speed at which the storm itself is moving. Those are often vastly different figures. While hurricanes can produce winds that whirl as fast as a race car, the systems themselves can plod along at the pace of a person taking a stroll. Slower storms can dump biblical amounts of rain in a more limited area over longer periods of time. That increases the risk of those in its path. Other threats, like storm surge, aren't measured by a hurricane's category either. Nevertheless, hurricane categories have become a convenient shorthand for those looking to understand the storm. When one gets downgraded right before making landfall, some people may wrongly interpret that as a sign of a lessened threat, leading them to make ill-informed decisions about whether or not to evacuate. In recent years, the National Weather Service has developed more precise ways to communicate a hurricane's threat. It also falls to meteorologists and politicians to pound home the idea that a storm can be dangerous at any point on the scale. In the days before Florence hit, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper showed one way to do so. Quote, "My message is clear," unquote. Disaster is at the doorstep and is coming in. I have a question for you. Who put the Indian in Indian Summer? Well, Melissa Moore, who has a weekly column in the Christian Science Monitor weekly paper, has a question for us, and she goes on to explain how Indian Summer got its name. This in the September 17th issue. She says, "If the temperature has dropped and then risen again, my kids are in school and I think it's Indian summer. But I realize that I stretched the definition too far. What is Indian summer actually, and why do we call it that? There are some quite specific criteria. According to the American Meteorological Society, it is a period of abnormally warm temperatures in October or November, featuring clear skies but hazy air, following a long spell of cool weather and a killing frost. People often use the term more loosely, though, to mean any stretch of balmy weather after a cold snap, which can occur as early as September and as late as January. In areas with hot, humid summers and cold winters, Indian summer is often considered the most pleasant time of the year. During these few weeks, or few days perhaps, the northeastern United States experiences the climate of paradise," as a mapmaker named Thomas Pownall put it in 1776. Metaphorically, Indian summer refers to any happy, calm, or productive period late in the life of a person or a culture. Music critics often note that composer Richard Strauss had an Indian summer when, in his last 5 years of life, got inspiration once more. Literary critics describe how nearly 1,000 years after its golden age, Greek poetry enjoyed a remarkable Indian summer in the age of Justinian, 527 to 565, if you cast your minds back. The term's etymology is vexed. It was first used in the northeastern U.S. in the 18th century. But that is all we can say with relative certainty. Some explanations of its origins hold that native Americans shared their language of the environment and climate with early settlers, much as they shared their food at the first Thanksgiving. It has been cited variously as the period when Native Americans preferred to hunt, or stored food for the winter, or lit lots of campfires. Other folk etymologies reveal more overt racism, asserting that it gained its name because Native Americans used the unexpected good weather to sneak up on an unsuspecting settler and attack. Other accounts make a connection between the deceitfulness of the season. It looks like summer, but it's a trick with the supposed untrustworthiness of Native Americans, exemplified by the derogatory term Indian giver. Given the term's possible racist origins, we might expect its usage to be declining today when we are paying more and more attention to the power of words and symbols that are or might be considered derogatory. There is some evidence that this is occurring, but it's quite equivocal. What else could we call this lovely season? In many European languages, it's Old Woman's Summer. "I'll take that," she said. "Melissa Moore," said, "as long as I can go outside without a coat in November." The following have been noted in the magazine The Week, August 31st of this year. A record 72,000 Americans died from drug overdoses in 2017. That was up 10% from the previous year, according to new data from the Centers for Disease Control. The practice of mixing the highly potent opioid fentanyl into street drugs such as heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine is a major factor in the increased death toll. Moreover, Americans are eating out a lot more. With the annualized 3-month gain in sales at dining and drinking establishments rising over 25%, to $61 billion. That's the fastest surge since 1992, according to a new Department of Commerce report. And then there's this. More than 2,000 prison inmates are fighting California's wildfires. But it will be almost impossible for them to get firefighter jobs in the state once they are released. Most California fire departments require an EMT license. An EMT certifying boards typically reject applicants with criminal convictions. No gratitude there. And Democrats running for state and federal offices this year think stricter gun control is a winning message. Running over 82,000 political ads on this so far. Nearly 60% of all ads on guns in 2018 have favored stricter laws. And that's up 31% from 2016. And just 11% in 2014. And finally, women have won 65%, that is 90 out of 138, of the Democratic open primary elections this year, in which at least one man and one woman were running. And then we'll go on to something which is a bit unusual. However, it has come to light as scientists have discovered many explanations for the collapse of Mayan civilization 1,000 years ago, including deforestation, overpopulation, and war. But now, researchers think they've identified the real culprit: a crippling, decades-long drought. The team analyzed sediment under Lake Chichicanab on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, the Mayan heartland. Specifically, they studied water trapped within gypsum crystals, which form at the bottom of lakes during extreme drought. They calculated that the area experienced a 50% decrease in annual precipitation from 800 to 1000 AD. And then over some periods, rainfall declined by up to 70%. A climate change was potentially a driving force of the downfall, according to the researchers from Cambridge University in the UK. A lot of things that cause the disintegration of a civilization: lack of food, outbreaks of disease, environmental degeneration can be a consequence of drought. Another question today: what are you watching? Well, Christian Science Monitor Weekly have written in to the editor to tell what they have been watching recently and want to share their responses. First of all, Joseph Addison, writing from Silistra, Bulgaria, says this: Casablanca deserves its place in film history, and as a story of integrity and sacrifice in the face of oppression. It speaks as powerfully now as it ever did. Love wins in the end, but not romance. The greater love of humanity is the driver, and Rick's return to it is the real victory and the moment we cheer. Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman probably still retain the highest profiles, but Claude Rains turned in a pitch-perfect performance. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences should list as one of the great errors that Rains did not take the Supporting Actor Award in 1943. And then from Kim Gasner, Orlando, Florida, and she says this about what she's watching: I have a handful of what to me are perfect movies. They may not meet the standards of great movies, but they are perfectly cast, entertaining, and have that special something that makes me stop whatever I'm doing and it draws me in. These are Singing in the Rain, Cabaret, The Princess Bride, The Shawshank Redemption, Victor Victoria, and Amadeus. Do you agree with her on this? Well, another letter was sent to the Monitor by Tara Doe of Clifton Park, New York. And she said, I watch a lot of detective shows from Icelandic countries and several British detective stories. The one I just saw was called Jordskott, which aired on SVT in Sweden and on the AMC streaming service Shudder in the United States. I'm hoping the BBC One will take it upon itself to show Happy Valley, which is available on Netflix in the U.S. and has another season. It was a good British show with a great cast. In addition, I like anything that actress Anne Dowd is in. She was in HBO's The Leftovers, and she stars in TNT's Good Behavior as an FBI detective. And now, from the column The Bottom Line in the magazine The Week, this is August the 31st, once more. It says, the world's middle class now totals 3.7 billion people, or 48% of the world population. More than half the world should be in the middle class by 2020. Of the world's developed economies, 19 legally mandate more time off than 15 days a year that the average American worker gets. A quarter of U.S. private sector workers, roughly 28 million, receive no paid time off from their jobs at all. Maybe that's something we should look into. Americans are saving more of their income. The government has pushed up its estimate of the personal saving rate from 3.3 to 7.2. That comes to $613 billion in additional savings, enough money to purchase more than 20 million Ford F-150 pickup trucks or 600 million iPhone X's. Think about that. I'm going to close today with an item from the environment, and we're going to Siberia for this. From the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, September 17th, there is a fine article entitled "The Lake That Holds Siberia's Heart." Almost all of the people in the Russian Republic of Buryatia describe themselves as environmentalists. It is the presence of the unspeakably beautiful Lake Baikal, the world's oldest and deepest lake, that has shaped that attitude. Legend has it that Genghis Khan, who once ruled here, decreed that there would be no hunting, fishing, or even walking around the shores of the lake. The native Buryats, some of whom still practice a version of his faith, continue to regard Lake Baikal as a sacred place. It was even an inspiration for the Soviet Union's first environmental movement, when plans to build a pulp and paper mill on its shore in the 1970s were stymied by an unprecedented, emotion-charged public outcry. And that's going to bring us to the end of today's program. Thank you for tuning in. We do want you to come back, enjoy your company. Take care, and later, I'll be back. Stay tuned for classical music in bite-sized nuggets on 101.5 FM, Huntley Community Radio.